The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, everyone. And to me, it feels like it's already the new year. This is the last day, I guess, of 2017. And I don't know, there's so many people here today. Like, what happens with New Year's resolutions? And people come for a while. So welcome, everyone. And kind of also anticipating that people often start a new year with aspirations, with intentions, and often is a time to kind of refresh one's commitment to various things. Not a few people become interested in their Buddhist practice and meditation practice and would like to find some way to engage it more seriously or more regularly than they usually do with the new year and kind of fresh start. And with that idea, I thought I would talk today about some of the ways to sustain a practice. Because actually is meditation practice, and especially mindfulness, is actually a very easy thing. What's difficult is to continue doing it and to keep it up, to sustain it, both, you know, over the minutes in which we meditate, but also through a year, through a life. And so what are the ways to support or help us sustain it and keep it going? So a few things about this is I want to first say more personally that it's been one of the greatest blessings of my life to have this practice and to the degree to which I've been able to practice. It's unimaginable to me how my life would be without it. Certainly would have been radically different. So I feel very grateful to have had the chance to do so much of it and engage and keep it going for now for over 40 years. And, you know, it's knowing what a blessing it can be, what benefits can come from it. I'm very inspired to support other people in tasting, touching into some of that as well. So that's a little bit behind giving this talk. And thinking about this topic, there's two things that the Buddha said that maybe are pertinent. One is, he said that what he teaches is for people who feel. It's a kind of a very peculiar statement, for people who feel. And he put a tremendous emphasis on direct experience, much more so than beliefs and ideas. And it's possible to read Buddhist books and learn the ideas of Buddhism, but that's very different from feeling it or feeling into it and feeling into oneself. And that the practice is meant for people who take the time or have the ability or the interest to really feel deeply what's going on in this life, feel into themselves, into their lives. So the Dharma is for those who feel. And so the idea of taking time to really feel or be interested in feeling ourselves, feeling down into the depths of ourselves, of what's really going on, is part of what this is about. The other thing he said is that about his teaching is that it's a teaching of action. And so it's not a passive practice we do. It's a teaching, it's an active practice, even though part of the activity of practice is to sit still in meditation. It's still understood to be an active engagement, an engagement to wake up, to be present, to be attentive. Engagement, the activity, to help us release the stress we have, to release all the extra swirling and twirling and agitation we have in our mind. The mind gets very still and very peaceful, but it's an action which brings us that. It's a way of being. And so I say that because one of the actions is to meditate. The Buddhist practice is not wishful thinking. One of the maybe irritating things I like to say is that Buddhist practice doesn't work. I pause. And then I'll say, unless you do it. So, there's people, including myself at times, where I kind of thought I was doing it or kind of was complaining about my practice, and then I realized I wasn't really doing it. I wasn't applying it and wasn't engaged. So the Dharma is to feel deeply, and the Dharma is to be engaged. So how do we engage? How do we sustain it? One of the ways is to understand, have a clear sense of how it is important, or a clear sense of what is important for us, what's really valuable for us in our lives. And I think this question of what we most value, what's most important, is something that is very helpful to keep close to ourselves and to keep asking day after day, month after month, year after year, because it changes over time. So we can kind of, there's deeper and deeper layers to discover what's most important and what's most valuable. And for people who feel, to feel deeply into oneself and really kind of, not stay at the idea level, not stay at the idea of desires, because so many of our desires are surface desires, but to really drop down to what maybe can be called aspirations, or what is the heart's deepest intention and what's most important. And then how does meditation practice fit into that? I think that's a lot easier to sustain a meditation practice if we have a clear sense that this somehow is connected to what is most important for us. If it's not connected to what's most important, then perhaps we shouldn't do it. Because we have, our human life is very important, and in some sense we don't have much time. And you don't want to waste it doing things which are not related to what is most important. And so, but if you can really feel the connection between what's most important and meditation, then it's easier to want to do it and, be committed to doing it. So to reflect on that for oneself, really think about that for a while, is very helpful. Now, in terms of what the Buddhism traditionally says, is that one of the most important things is to find a life where we don't suffer, and a life we don't intentionally cause suffering and harm in the world around us. That this is an ethical direction. That somehow, the Buddha didn't use the word ethics in the way that the English word exactly, but the Buddhist teachings is profoundly ethical. Over and over again, the focus is on how we live a good life, how we live a life that doesn't cause harm to self or others, and how we live a life that is for the welfare of self and others. And that, how is that important? As is one of the things that characterizes the Buddha's teachings is that it's not theistically based. There were plenty of gods in the pantheon of India at the time of the Buddha, but these gods were a little bit relegated to what is it called in acting? Kind of, bit players on the side. Supporting roles, thank you. Yes, they're supporting roles. They're not actually that important. And and so one of the things that happens in philosophy, for example, is that when different philosophers in the time of Greece, time of the Enlightenment in Europe, and the modern world and psychology, when people don't have gods to rely on or religious authority from, God-given books to rely on for what is true, what humans tend to come to is something that could be called more like, one person calls it the pleasure principle. But the idea of using our own way of experiencing, our own ability to feel deeply, what is painful and what is pleasant, what is experientially a deep sense of happiness, peace, and what is suffering and agitation and lack of peace. And this ability, to have that as a fundamental orientation and guide for how we live our lives, is what the Buddha offers. And it would seem that it's a little bit hedonistic to have this kind of emphasis, but there is no other good basis, if you're using empirical experience, for really finding your way to what's really deep and profound. And this question of using, you know, tuning into what is welfare and what is not, becomes more and more subtle as you go deeper and deeper into meditation. We get to see how the subtlety of the mind, how it works, and we get to see the compass of moving forward, away from suffering, away from the causes of suffering, moving towards the causes of happiness and well-being, gets more and more subtle and profound, and more and more sublime, more and more satisfying in a very, very deep way. And at some point, it can feel like nothing else is more important about where to come from, where to live in ourselves, than the deep, deep, satisfying sense of well-being and the motivation to work for the welfare of self and for others. So anyway, this is kind of, in Buddhist point of view, this is kind of be understood as being kind of what's most important. And meditation practice supports this because it gives us the first-hand evidence, the first-hand information we need in order to follow this path away from suffering and towards welfare and well-being. So it's not a matter of looking at the books and learning principles and learning ethical rules, learning someone else's idea of what you should do and all that, but rather it's meditation is the way of reading the book in oneself and discover for oneself how this is done. And to do it well enough so that we have real confidence that this has profound value for ourselves and for others, to have discovered some depth of peace and depth of stillness or depth of freedom from being caught up in the reactivity that people are often caught up in. So that's at least from the Buddhist point of view, but if you might have your own understandings and ideas of why meditation is important or how it fits into your life. But to reflect on that is one of the ways to have the kind of the intellectual support for sustaining the practice. The second thing that helps is once you understand how meditation is important is to be inspired to do it. To have not only to kind of know what's important for yourself, but to have a degree of trust or faith or inspiration or enthusiasm for doing it. And so what is it that gives you enthusiasm? What is it that gives you faith or inspiration? How can you tap into sources of inspiration or faith or trust so that you have greater trust in the value, for example, of meditating every day than you would perhaps checking Google News every day? Greater trust in meditating every day than watching TV. Greater trust in meditation than many of the things that people do in their daily life, which maybe if you put them on a scale of what's most important and what's most valuable, maybe some of the things we do don't really hold up on the scale. So where do we put our trust? What do we inspire to do in our lives? And how can we tap into a place of inspiration, of faith, is also one of the tasks, I think, that are very helpful to consider. So some of you, it might be listening to Dharma talks. I find it phenomenal because I didn't grow up this way in Buddhism, that there are these talks online that people can listen to. Apparently, I say, because I still don't listen to talks online. And there's this place called Audio Dharma that people keep referring to. But, you know, I hardly know how to navigate. Believe it or not, probably pretty simple to do it. I haven't figured out how to download a talk from Audio Dharma onto my smartphone because I never do it. And so, but, you know, it's, anyway, so, but people listen to these talks and you know, other talks, other teachers, And I think it's been really, you know, kind of a delight for me to see the inspiration, the support that listening to Dharma talks can have for people. The reading books used to be something people did to get inspired. Knowing other practitioners, coming to groups like this, and perhaps there's people here who you've seen how they practice and see their demeanor and how they are, and it inspires you that someone practices for a while, that there's something about them that say, oh yeah, this is good, I want to do this. Then, related to all this, is also a sense of purpose, to be your intention. And this is related, of course, to what's important and what inspires us. But I think of it a little bit different, that intention or sense of purpose is what's going to engage us, what we want to do, how we want to do it. And I think that spending time really asking ourselves what's important and what's my intention is maybe more important than meditating every day. If you did those two things every day, you know, I think it would clarify a lot. I did this for quite a while in my life, in my early years of practice. I would spend every day, some time every day, considering what is my deepest intention for today. And some days I had the same answer. But what was interesting over the days was how it shifted and changed. And sometimes I started discovering that I would get to a certain kind of thing that I thought, this is my deepest intention for today. And then I would say, well, let's keep thinking about it and reflecting on it. And then I would drop deeper and deeper. One of the interesting things I discovered was that if I asked myself, what is my deepest intention? And my answer was stated in the negative, then I wasn't deep enough. So, for example, if I said, oh, my deepest intention is to live without fear. That's a great intention. I certainly want to support anybody who has that wish. But it's a negative statement, right? So the way to take it further, one way is to say, ask, if you could live without fear, what then would be your intention? I've asked people this sometimes, and some people will come back and say, oh, then I would love. But once they say that love is a deeper intention rather than being free of fear, then sometimes they can shift their focus to the underlying impetus to love, and that becomes the sun that melts the fear. So rather than having to deal always with the fear directly, sometimes if you can go deeper and deeper, there's something deeper somehow that can resolve these issues. Another thing that supports doing meditation practice regularly is time. I don't want to say time management, but because when people have a Sabbath, I don't think that's time management. And the Sabbath is kind of an idea of day of rest, sacred day of rest. But to give ourselves time to meditate, time for a mindful life, because the momentum, the movements of our inner life, learning to touch into it, learning to settle, quiet, the active, agitated, thinking mind, it takes time. This whole meditation practice, in a certain kind of way, is not very efficient. You know, we would like to, I mean, nowadays there are people who are trying to make it much more efficient. And maybe they will, and maybe in a few, you know, there'll be better ways to meditate than just sitting down by oneself and closing one eyes. And I mean, there's people who, there's apps now, and there's devices and all kinds of things that speed. And there used to be, back in my days, before there was, you know, brain machines that people put on their heads and apps and all that, we had a less, more technologically simple way of speeding it up. It was called, like, you know, maybe LSD.
Yeah.
But most people who, you know, went through that phase stopped doing it and found that that was maybe good, but it's time, but, it's actually more valuable not to do it. But there's something very important about doing the inner work that's required if we use nothing too extra to support us in the practice. But we really have to face ourselves directly. To use a drug, to use some kind of other device, there's all kinds of, in these years I've been doing these practices, and I've gone through all kinds of workshops and different things over the years, and there's some fantastic techniques that can get you concentrated really fast, can get you high really fast without drugs, without machines. There's things that can be done. But I don't think that, I won't say they're not valuable. They have their place. But I think what I put value in is not bypassing the work of sitting down quietly and facing oneself, being with what's here, not trying to get away from it quickly, not trying to fix it quickly, not trying to avoid what's here, but to take a time to feel and to be here. And in the slow, seemingly inefficient way, learn to really work with and see and resolve and heal, dissolve some of the deeper complexes, some of the deeper issues that are going on in our lives that help us become mature practitioners. People have the ability to sit quietly and look the monsters right in the face. The ability to be present in the middle and the difficulties of life and be still, alert, and present, engaged, without needing to go reach for something else to somehow solve our issues for us. So time. Give ourselves time. Take the time. Make sure when you meditate that you don't do it in a hurry. Today I'm going to meditate for 10 minutes and I'm going to, nail it in 10 minutes. And then move on to the next thing. But to sit down with it, even if you have only 10 minutes to meditate, to sit down with a sense during those 10 minutes that you're giving yourself infinite time. This is a time to have time and not feel like you're in a hurry. And one of the reasons for this is the feeling or the idea or the sense of I'm in a hurry, to be in a rush, is more mental activity. And what we're trying to do is to calm the surface mental activity so we can really see what's going on more deeply. So to be in a hurry is actually going in the wrong direction. Another thing that helps us sustain practice is to have support. I can confidently say that if I did not have support from other practitioners and the teachers I've had over these years, I would not have practiced for this long, and I would not have grown as much as I have through the practice. I didn't realize that at the time in the first decade or so of my practice, but when I looked back, I realized that without the support and the encouragement and the modeling that I received, without the sitting together with other people in groups, I wouldn't have done it. Some people can do it that way on their own as hermits. It takes a lot of strength of character to do it and a lot of determination. I probably didn't have it when I first started practicing. So I was really dependent on support from other people. And I still feel to this day that I don't know if supported is the right word, but I'm certainly maybe supported is okay. I'm supported by the inspiration I get when I practice with other people. When I come down here to IMC, like on Sunday morning, and meditate with all of you, it's a different feeling than when I meditate at home. And I like meditating quietly home alone. That's no problem. But to be together as a group and to feel the intentionality, to feel the dedication, to feel the interest, to be in a room of other people being still, it just makes me so happy that it makes me want to just do more of it. It gives me more inspiration to continue doing it. It's a great thing. So practicing with others, for some people, is a tremendous support. I know some people who like coming to a sitting group like here Sunday morning, at least once a week, because it kind of gives them a boost. And then through the rest of the week, they can keep inspired to keep sitting and practicing. And and some people, I think, who feel, yes, I sit at home and I'm calmer and more still because, you know, it's how people close the doors loud here and people walk across the wooden floor with their heavy boots and clomp around and then they take off their Velcro jackets and you know, all kinds of wonderful things here that goes on. And so some people, you know, feel that, yes, you know, it's quieter at home. However, to be honest, it's still, the fact that I was here has given me a boost, and now I'm much more likely to keep practicing at home. It's inspiring or meaningful in some way. Another thing that supports ongoing practice is to be careful, be attentive to the attitudes you bring along in your practice. Are you overly idealistic? Some people sit down and they expect to get into deep, concentrated states in 10 minutes. Or they expect that, you know, enlightenment is just around the corner. And, you know, I've been meditating now for a week and, you know, it's what's wrong? And so sometimes people are too idealistic, and in doing that, or too high expectation of what's supposed to happen too quickly. And so then they get disappointed and they give up. Or they say, well, maybe another day is better, or maybe, you know, that didn't work today, but I'll read a book and maybe learn about a different meditation practice and try that. And not realizing that this is a slow unfolding. The Buddha called it a gradual path. And there's something very maturing about just giving yourself time. And also the idea of being too idealistic, living for ideals, it's often a way of not really taking the time to feel what is actually happening, what's actually going on here. And there's a little slogan: if there's a gap between the ideal and what is actual, choose the actual in terms of the mindfulness, in terms of what you pay attention to. Really study the actual. Be with it. Be present for it. See what's going on. Get to the bottom of it. Sense it. Find your freedom with it. Try not to be too ambitious or too conceited in doing the practice. There's plenty of people who, you know, have strong ambition. In the 40 years ago when I started practicing, there was competitive meditation. I remember I was so silly. We would have these, one of the ways that I got caught up in this kind of competitive idea of meditation was we would sometimes have this, we were in the monasteries, we would do this, you know, we'd meditate in the evening, and sometimes there was this optional required late night sitting that had no bell that ended it. So you were supposed to sit there, and then when you were ready, you can go to bed. And this, you know, optional required sitting, everyone was there. And then, who was going to go to bed first? Who was going to be the slackard? Who was going to be the one who would, wouldn't, you know? And so I would sit there sometimes and go, I'm not going to go to bed before that person does. And I'm a better meditator because I'm going to stay here. This is what I'm thinking in my mind, right? I'm a good meditator because I'm going to sit here and not go until that person goes. And that person should go. Can't they go? What's wrong? what's wrong with them? They're not really meditating. Who's not really meditating? It was me. So, you know, no competitive meditation. It also doesn't work very well to compare oneself with other people. We certainly can contrast ourselves or learn from the example of other people, but to compare ourselves and our value as a meditator by what other people are experiencing or doing is not really the point of it all. The point is to wake up, to feel, to be with how it is for you. And what it is for you is very important. Who you are is important. Your experience in life is important. And it's so important that you don't want to try to have someone else's experience. Your path is your path through your own kind of way. So no need to compare yourself. Someone else is getting concentrated and I'm not. Someone else is getting calm and I'm not. Someone else is whatever. The idea is to be very careful of those kinds of attitudes, because those attitudes can be discouraging, and so people then will stop practicing. The other thing that I had to learn early in my practice was to be careful with attitudes of being lazy or complacent. There were times where I would just kind of like, I'll get to it. This is important, yes, and, just a little bit later in the day. And then later would come, yeah, I'll get to it. Later in the day. And now it's night and I'm tired. I don't think this is a good time to meditate. Let's try tomorrow. So there's kind of I had a certain kind of laziness or complacency that sometimes would settle in that undermined my practice. And so I had to learn a certain degree of self-discipline to keep showing up. And one of the great lessons that I had was that at some point I realized that when I was meditating alone, without a group of people, I realized that the discipline had to come from inside of me. Because one of the nice things about sitting with a group of people, the discipline is supported by other people. We sit here, sometimes 35 minutes, sometimes 45 minutes. Some people find they can do it that length here at IMC, but they don't really feel like they can do it well at home. They don't have the discipline for it, or it seems like too long of a stretch. But at some point, I realized for myself that with whatever sense of complacency, resistance, laziness that I had, that I had to awaken and develop a certain degree of discipline that I didn't have earlier, that I had to rely on myself. And that was invaluable for me to be able to stay in the practice. And I suspect, I don't remember so well back 40 years ago now, but I kind of suspect that I had a certain feeling of indignation, or that I had to do that. That, I shouldn't have to work so hard. And so. Another interesting way of reflection for sustaining the practice is to give time about how you're going to fit the practice into your life. So be intentional about it. Look at your life, look at what's important, and really kind of figure out where does it fit so that I can do it regularly. Some people, it really works to do it first thing in the morning. Some people, it absolutely doesn't work to do it then. It works to do it in the evening. Some people I've known have had the most success doing it regularly to do it during the lunchtime. Some people, at the end of the day, and they come home before the evening kind of begins. There's different times, different ways in which it fits in. Some people, have the idea, well, at IMC we sit for 35, 45 minutes, so I need to do that at home. But that doesn't fit into the life, that lots of kids and work or whatever. But what might work is 15 minutes. So we do it 15 minutes. It's better that than not do it at all. So to really reflect a little bit, how does it fit? How can I make it fit in a realistic way so it's sustainable? And then there's the flipping that question around, which can be quite powerful. So instead of asking, how is the practice going to fit into my life? It's possible to ask the question, how will my life fit into the practice? And why that's powerful is that it gives priority to the practice. And for some people, maybe it's something you discover over time, it's kind of like practice is the most important part of being alive. Practice is the essence. Practice is really what we want to orient or live our life around. And my practical life, my ordinary kind of activities of life, need to fit into that. Having a job, having taken care of things, all things. Those are going to be support for something which is deep and more valuable, which is the practice. So for some people, it comes to that point where The practice becomes the most important thing, and the question then is, how does their life fit into that? Then a few more things I'll say kind of quickly. Regularity of practice is important. By practicing regularly, there can be momentum. We kind of settle into a groove, so it becomes easier and easier. If we don't have a regular practice, then, you know, we don't do it for a few days, and we think, maybe I should do it, but, you know. But after, if you do it regularly, there's no question, this is what I do. Kind of like brushing your teeth, I hope, for you. That, you know, you don't think about needing to brush your teeth, you just do it at the time before you go to bed or something. So you get up in the morning and you sit because that's what you do. There's no question, there's no negotiations because it's a regular part of their life. Not too idealistic, perhaps, and maybe a little more realistic. One wonderful technique that I've heard some people use is to meditate six times a week, but not necessarily 6 days. So it means that you're committed to meditating six times a week. Somebody gives you one day off if you want. But if so for some reason life circumstances come along and make it hard to do it regularly day after day, that's okay because then you make it up. And next day you do 2 days, two times meditation. So you didn't do it on Wednesday, so you remember that. So come Saturday when you have more time, then you make up for it. So some people have that find that kind of regularity helpful. Patience. I think that without discovering how to be patient, I think most people are not going to find their way with meditation. It's probably one of the first lessons, just to be patient. It helps to have integrity. Buddhism puts a tremendous importance on ethical integrity as the foundation for meditation. Perhaps it helps us not be agitated. It helps us to not have regrets and remorse that we don't want to sit and have to deal with and be present for. And some people avoid meditation because it's a way that their lack of integrity will catch up to them. Someone says the unresolved or challenging issues of our life will eventually catch up to you if you meditate regularly. And that's a good thing to have that happen. And then the final thing I'll say that that I think is a tremendous support for sustaining the practice is to sprinkle in some modicum of love. So to have some modicum of love for oneself, love for others, love for the world, to have somehow the context in which we do this practice be one of care, compassion, love, kindness. Because then it starts becoming more automatically or rewarding to do it or nourishing to do it. And love is not always easy to have. But to consider that it has a role and a place in supporting the practice and in supporting us to be mindful and present, maybe we can tap into it or evoke it or find it more often than you would if you didn't have that thought. Where is the love? Where is love in all this? Where is love in being mindful? Where is mindfulness in being loving? And one of the surprises for me in these years that I practiced mindfulness is at some point I couldn't tell a difference between mindfulness and love. For a long time I could, but at some point they seemed to come together. And the very act of being mindful came with as a form of love. The very idea of love came with mindfulness and two became inseparable. So those are ways that maybe for this coming year will sustain your practice, support it. And if it's your intention to have meditation practice or mindfulness be a regular part of this 2018, then I hope that some of these ideas today will inspire you or fuel you or kind of keep you going. And perhaps coming to IMC or other groups and is in a way that you'll be sustained and supported through the year. May you have all the support you need so that your practice is sustained. It's for the welfare of yourself and the welfare of the world. May it be that your practice this coming year is beneficial for the world that you live in. May all beings be happy. So thank you all.